Good evening, everyone, except in Western Australia, where it's still good afternoon. Can I welcome you all to the National Admiralty Seminar on the Judicial Sale of Ships. Let me start off by offering the apology of the Chief Justice, who's unable to be here today as he's on leave overseas. He would, I'm sure, have dearly loved to have been able to open the proceedings. A judicial sale, in effect, is said to clean the ship's hull. That's a reference to the concept of removing things from a ship, such as the effect of a bottomry bond, where the notion of cleaning the hull comes from, I suspect, and maritime liens, as well as other interests that have arisen that could affect the rights of third parties who wish to buy a ship free of any liens or other interests. The purpose of a judicial sale is to offer a degree of security to purchasers for that purpose, and to create or realise a fund from the sale to pay out those who have interests, such as the holders of maritime liens or rights in rem against the ship and other unsecured creditors of the ship owner and those who deal with her, in order of priority of the particular forum in which the sale occurs. Tonight's speakers will range over many aspects of judicial sales. We're very privileged to have such a distinguished panel of speakers, all of whom have got considerable legal and academic experience in this field. Our first speaker will be Professor Sarah Derrington, whom Justice Bezanco, who will be speaking to us from Adelaide, will introduce shortly. She's going to discuss the topic of judicial sales before final judgment as contemplated under Rule 69 of the Admiralty Rules 1988. Greg Nels of Senior Counsel will examine some of the practical and legal issues that arise in judicial sales, and he'll be introduced by Justice McCarrigan from Perth. Our very experienced and wise national and maritime Admiralty and Maritime Registrar Tony Tesserero will talk about some of the other practical aspects of judicial sales that arise from the court's point of view and from the point of view of marshals. And finally, Stuart Hetherington, the President of the Comité Maritime International, will speak about particularly the attempts of the Comité, the CMI, to create an international convention to deal with the judicial sale of ships. That has a currency in Australia. In the recent past, there's been one full court case, Mentink and the Registrar of the Australian Registrar of Ships, 2015, 234 Federal Court Reports 458, that dealt with a claim for a wrongful removal of a registration and an attempt to reverse it without joining subsequent foreign registered owners. And I currently have a different type of case in my docket that is pending in respect of a ship that was sold by the Supreme Court of Singapore to an Australian purchaser who has unsuccessfully tried to have her registered here. The registrar has refused registration on the basis that there is a conflicting registration for the ship in Taiwan that has not, to this point, removed that registration, although there are now proceedings apparently in the Taiwanese courts to seek to bring that about. So, as you can see, this is not a mere academic exercise, but it has a practical application in the order of the court. Can I now hand over to Justice Bezanco to introduce Professor Derrington?
Yes. Thank you, Justice Rareys. I was also going to mention the problem that Justice Rareys has briefly alluded to in his remarks, so here goes, I can state the problem. As Justice Rareau said, a judicial sale of a ship would ordinarily result in the purchaser receiving a clear title and being able to choose the place in which the ship is registered. Claims against the ship are transferred to claims against the fund, being the proceeds of sale. Difficulties arise where the judicial sale is not recognised in another jurisdiction, or for some reason its effects are not carried out. A purchaser might find his or her ship arrested for a pre-sale debt or other liability in a jurisdiction which does not recognise the judicial sale. Alternatively, a purchaser may wish to register his or her ship in a jurisdiction where registration is only permitted in circumstances where all prior registrations are closed, and yet there is an extant pre-judicial sale registration in another jurisdiction. And what does the purchaser do in such circumstances? One option is to approach a court in the place of the proposed registration. If that's done, what order is sought? Another is to approach the court which ordered the sale and ask for an order that the appropriate official of that court have the authority to execute the document which will close the prior registration. Is there room for a practical solution such as discussions between registrars in those circumstances? As Justice Rareau mentioned, this problem has come before the court recently. He has a case where the purchaser wished to register the ship in Australia. In a case where the judicial sale had taken place in Singapore and there was extant registration in Taiwan. Section 17 of the Shipping Registration Act 1981 prohibits registration of a ship, that is a Commonwealth Act, if it is registered under a law of a foreign country. So that's the problem. Could I now turn to introduce Professor Sarah Derrington, who, as Justice Rareau's mentioned, is going to address sales before judgment. Professor Derrington is Academic Dean and Head of the T.C. Burns School of Law at the University of Queensland. She has published in leading international journals in the field of marine insurance and carriage of goods by sea, and with James M. Turner, Queen's Counsel of the English Bar, co-authored The Law and Practice of Admiralty Matters, now in its second edition. She serves on the boards of the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, the Australian Maritime College, and the Australian National Maritime Museum. She is a fellow of the Australian Academy of Law and the Nautical Institute, and a titular member of CMI. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Bezanko, Your Honours, ladies and gentlemen, and Justice Rareau in particular, thank you very much for inviting me to speak this evening. So, as you've heard, I'm addressing the topic of sales pendant lite, which attempts to outline the principles applicable to an order for the sale of a ship before judgment but after arrest, and discusses the evidence that might be needed in support of such an application. The paper then discusses the approach that has been taken in a number of courts to applications for a direct sale. Now, as Justice Rareau has already indicated, the rules clearly contemplate an order for sale before judgment, and in particular, Rule 69, Subrule 5 assists in that regard. But it must be remembered that such an order can only be made by the Admiralty Judge and not by the Registrar. Now, turning to the principles, it's been clear now for many years that a court should not make an order for the appraisement or sale of a ship pendant lite, whether or not the action is defended, except for good reason. And the principles were established as early as 1977 by Justice Brandon in the Murto. So normally, an order for sale before judgment will be sought only where there is default of appearance or defence. And in such circumstances, it's common practice for the court to make an order on the basis that the security for the claim will be diminished by the continuing costs of maintaining the arrest to the disadvantage of all of those interested in the ship. If the action is defended, then the court will examine the question of whether there is good reason for making the order more critically. And a significant factor influencing that decision will be the effect of maintaining the arrest on the value of the claimant's security. Now, this is true even where the claim is vigorously defended, as it was in the case of the Cape Don, which I'm sure some of you will remember. On all the evidence in that case, the ship was deteriorating, AMSA had detained it, it required substantial sums to bring it up to the state where it could be moved from where it was presently berthed. The owner was not contributing to any of the expenses, and the marshal's costs were accruing at about $7,500 a day. So in all of those circumstances, Justice Cooper held that the interests of the creditors generally and of the owner and of the claimant against the vessel were best served by ordering appraisement and sale pendant lite so that the funds could be paid into court and the claimants could argue about them later. Now, sub-rule 5 of Rule 69 is not predicated on a requirement of affirmative proof that the ship is deteriorating in value. Even if a ship is being maintained by the crew in accordance with the maintenance schedules, it's inevitable that there will be some deterioration in condition, for example, by reason of rust below the waterline, and various other factors affecting the hull that can't be arrested until the next dry docking. And secondly, in the absence of evidence of a rising market or ships of the particular age or type, the natural inference is that there will be some depreciation in value merely by the passage of time, even with full and adequate maintenance. And this was acknowledged in the case of the ship Ionian Mariner in 1995. Where an order is made and a vessel is sold pendant lite, it is still the marshal who must appraise the vessel and advertise it and invite offers for the sale of the vessel in accordance with the established rules of the court. So what sort of evidence might you need in bringing an application for such an order? It might include things like the overall value of the claim, which should be evident on the court material, evidence of the number of caveats against release and other claims pending against the ship and their likely value, the current value of the ship and its likely diminution in value during the course of arrest, the costs of maintaining the vessel's arrest, including port and berth charges, ship's keeper, crew wages and emoluments, supply of domestic fuel to the vessel, insurance, as we discovered in the High She. There are all sorts of expenses that might need to be put before the court in deciding whether or not such an application should be granted. Any necessary works that have to be done on the ship to keep it afloat or to enable it to be moved, the unwillingness of the ship owner to contribute to the costs of the arrest, as you saw in the Cape Don, is a matter that's taken into account. The financial position of the ship owner and his unwillingness or inability to provide security for the ship's release. It's also important to look at whether there is likely to be intervention of claimants with higher priority. The humanitarian considerations in relation to the crew on board are important. And finally, whether if the claimant obtains judgment in his favour, the judgment can be satisfied by the defendant without the need to sell the ship in any event. So although it's a relatively straightforward application, there are a variety of factors that really need to be addressed to persuade a judge to make such an order, given that the principle is against the making of such an order in the first instance. Now, I should mention private order before sale, which is different from direct sale. At any time up until an order for sale is made, the ship owner is at liberty to arrange for its sale. And if such sale is made, the ship will still remain under arrest and subject to the claim upon it. In a very old decision, 1922, called the Monmouth Coast, the court approved a private sale, but on condition that the proceeds be paid to the marshal on account of his expenses. And once such an order for sale is made, it is a contempt of court for the owner to attempt to sell the ship another time. Now, let me turn now to the question of whether or not applications for a direct sale should be granted. The economic climate has in recent years encouraged a spate of applications by mortgagees for a directed sale of the arrested ship in order to minimise the costs that accrue between arrest and sale. And the question of whether an order for a direct sale should be made is important. It goes to that important question raised both by Justices Rarey's and Bezanco of whether such a sale retains its character as a judicial sale, sufficient to convey clean title to the purchaser. Now, Stuart Hetherington will shortly discuss the draft convention on the judicial sale of ships. But suffice it to say, in my view, a direct sale, as I will discuss further, is likely to fall within the definition of that instrument, which has defined a judicial sale as being any sale of a ship accomplished by the competent court or under the control of a state by way of public auction or private treaty, or any other appropriate ways provided for by the law of the state where the judicial sale takes place, by which clean title of the ship is given to the purchaser and the proceeds of sale are made available to the creditors. So if it is accepted on our jurisprudence that a direct sale is permitted, albeit in limited circumstances, it seems to me that that would fall within the definition proposed by the new convention. Now, these types of applications have generally been refused by courts on the basis that powerful special features or special circumstances would need to be shown before such an application were acceded to. And absent those circumstances, the court will not order the marshal to sell to a purchaser found by the arresting party, even if the proposed price appears to be at or around the market value for the vessel. There seems to be some misunderstanding amongst academic commentators in some jurisdictions who have suggested that these types of applications are granted as a matter of course in England, Singapore, and Hong Kong, such that, and I quote, in common law jurisdictions, the time period between arrest and sale may be as little as a few weeks if the mortgagee makes such an application. But as Justice Tier held in the Union Gold, it is wrong in principle for the court to depart from the usual order that the marshal sell a vessel by appraisement advertisement and inviting bids to purchase the vessel. It may give the impression that the marshal is acting for a particular claimant in rem rather than as an officer of the court who must have regard to the interests of all claimants in rem and of the defendant shipowner. And the decision in the Union Gold reflects sentiments that had been voiced by Justice Wang in the earlier Hong Kong decision of the Margot L in 1997 and a much earlier decision of the Canadian Federal Court in the Dora No. 2 in 1977. More recently, in Singapore, in the Turtle Bay in 2013, Justice Ung agreed with Justice Tier, but went on to observe that in seeking the court's sanction of a private direct sale as an Admiralty judicial sale, a party is essentially seeking to attract the benefits and advantages of a judicial sale while retaining the liberty to sell the vessel to a party of its choice and at a price agreed between the two parties. And whilst acknowledging that such orders had been granted in the past, Justice Ung cautioned that it would be misguided to think that from those instances there now existed in Singapore an established practice of the court in exercise of its Admiralty jurisdiction to sanction private direct sales of arrested vessels as judicial sales. So I think the proposition is firmly against the granting of these applications in Singapore. To make it clear, she further considered the issue in 2014 in the sea urchin and was similarly unpersuaded to make an order for a direct sale. In that case, it was argued by the mortgagee that the direct sale of the vessel to a named buyer at a specified price was necessary to enable the vessel under new ownership to carry the cargo of soya beans to China. She distinguished the circumstances in the Union Gold and a Canadian decision called the Nell in concluding, no relation to this Nell, spelt differently. She distinguished the circumstances, concluding that without satisfactory evidence as to her value, the bank's assertion that the value of the security represented by the vessel would be progressively reduced by the costs of maintaining her under arrest, even with the existence of the perishable and perishing cargo on board, was not made out, and that the offer to employ the crew members by itself did not constitute a special circumstance. As an aside, the submission was also made in the sea urchin that the high cost of discharging the cargo was a factor that should have been taken into account by the court, given, so the submission went, that this would reduce the sale proceeds available to the in rem creditor. Justice Ung, with respect, correctly in my view, dismissed that submission on the basis that as a matter of general principle, the costs of discharging cargo are not part of the marshal's expenses and as such are an irrelevant consideration in determining whether to allow a direct sale. And Her Honour referred for authority for that proposition to the decision of Justice Sheen in the Dugo in 1981, that of Justice Harrington of the Federal Court of Canada in the MCP Altona in 2013, and a much earlier decision of Justice Cons of the Supreme Court of the High Court in the Mingren development. So what cases have permitted a direct sale? And there are only two or three that I've been able to find. The first is, of course, the Union Gold, decided by Justice Tia, to which I've already referred. That was a decision, though, involving applications for the direct sale of four vessels. He only permitted a direct sale of one, the Union Pluto. And the factors that persuaded him to order the direct sale of that one vessel only were these. The first was the age of the vessel. It was built in 1984. Somewhat worryingly, he described that as elderly. Its value was only €315,000. The buyer was in a position to retain and operate the long-term contract which provided for business for the Union Pluto and other vessels employing over 21 crew. The bank's claim against Union Pluto was €13.5 million, and none of the other claimants had a higher priority than the bank. And most importantly, the proposed buyer had a particular reason to buy the vessel, that is to continue running a particular business, and unless the sale took place immediately, there was a risk that that reason would disappear. So those were considered particular special circumstances that persuaded him to make the order. In Canada, orders approving private sales have been granted where the evidence is that the vessel is losing value, timing is essential to obtaining the best possible price, and there is convincing evidence that prior efforts to sell the vessel have not led to higher offers. In the Nell that I mentioned in 1997, the vessel had a cargo of sulphur on board that was to be shipped from Vancouver to Tunisia. And in this case, it was the cargo that was the extraordinary circumstance in the case. The court observing that should there be corrosion, the vessel's seaworthiness would be affected, making it difficult to sell at a good price. There was evidence that the vessel could well, within weeks and certainly months, become unsaleable except as scrap or at a minimal speculative price. The court observed that in addition to the sulphur being aboard the vessel for some 6 weeks here in Vancouver, with, as I have said, warmer than usual temperatures, she still has to complete her voyage. a usual voyage from Vancouver to Tunisia, not taking into account delays at the Panama Canal and delays in discharge at Tunisia, would take about 26 days, assuming a speed of 15 knots. Taking into account that most of the voyage from Vancouver through the Panama Canal to Tunisia would take place in subtropical and tropical climates, the concern of a corrosive reaction between steel plate and wet sulphur was a real and valid concern. So the order for direct sale was made in that case. The second Canadian case that ordered a direct sale was Offshore Interiors and Worldspan Marine in 2014, and the following factors persuaded Justice Mosley that it was fair and just and in the interests of all concerned that the directed sale be approved. The vessel had been under arrest for 4 years. The value of the vessel had already substantially deteriorated since its arrest. At least 25% of the work required to complete the build remained to be done. And the vessel had been aggressively marketed without success for several years, the court noting that the market for super yachts is very specialised. The vessel had a very limited market, and the evidence was that further advertisement or other marketing efforts would not produce a prospective buyer at a price greater than the offer. And any potential purchaser would face considerable risk due to the complexity and cost of completion. So in that case, the mortgagee's application for a directed sale succeeded. So, the three take-home points. An application for sale pendant lite can be made whether the claim is defended or not, but where it is clear that the security for the claim will be diminished by the continuing costs of maintaining the arrest to the detriment of all who are interested in the ship, not just the applicant. Evidence of a variety of factors will be important to persuade a court to make such an order. And finally, there is not a trend towards orders for direct sale of ships, and in principle they should be avoided unless there are compelling circumstances such as those that arose in the Nell. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to introduce the next speaker, who's a well-recognised leader in this field, as are the other speakers today. Gregory Nell, SC, is a member of the Sydney Bar, practising from new chambers, having commenced with the New South Wales Bar in 1991 and taking silk in 2006. Prior to being called to the Bar, Gregory had also been employed in the shipping practices of both Norton Smith & Co. in Sydney and Hill Dickinson Solicitors in London. Greg is speaking to us today on some practical aspects associated with the judicial sale of ships. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge, Your Honours, ladies and gentlemen. As His Honour has indicated, I've been tasked to speak about some of the practical and more mundane aspects associated with the judicial sale of ships, in particular from the practitioner's point of view. First, when can an order for sale be made? Rule 69.1 of the Admiralty Rules provides that the court may order that a ship be sold upon application by a party either before or after judgment. And Rule 69.5 provides that where the ship is deteriorating in value, the court can order its sale at any stage of the proceeding and with or without application. I don't propose to go over the aspects that Professor Derrington has dealt with, but do wish to make four brief observations about Rule 69. First, the court cannot order the sale of a ship unless the ship is under arrest and in the hands of the court in that capacity when the order is made. Secondly, it follows from the first point that an order for the sale of a ship cannot be made where either the ship has merely been served with an in rem writ without being arrested, or if it has been arrested but released from arrest following the provision of security for the plaintiff's claim, at least without the ship being arrested or rearrested first. That, of course, can only occur in Australia if the ship is in Australia or has returned to Australia, which might be unlikely if you obtain a judgment in rem against it. Although in those circumstances, the judgment in rem, if unsatisfied, may provide a basis upon which further in rem proceedings may be brought against the ship elsewhere and an order for the sale of the ship obtained there. There is another consequence that flows from the need to arrest the ship before the order for sale is made, and that is that if the vessel has previously been arrested and released from arrest, then it cannot be arrested again without an application being made under Section 21 of the Act to re-arrest the ship. That in turn requires persuading the court either that there was default in the performance of a guarantee or undertaking given to procure the release of the ship from its earlier arrest or some, quote, other sufficient reason, unquote, to justify the ship's re-arrest. You may also have difficulties if, in re-arresting the ship, if the security that was provided contained an undertaking not to arrest the ship again. Thirdly, it also follows from the first point that an order for the sale of or for the judicial sale of a ship cannot be made where the claim is being pursued in an action in personam, even if in the exercise of the court's admiralty jurisdiction. However, in those circumstances, it may be possible for the plaintiff to have the ship belonging to a defendant to that in personam action sold once it's obtained judgment against the defendant in that action, but this would be a sale by way of a writ of execution, or writ of fai-fai for those old enough to remember, rather than the judicial sale of the ship, and as such doesn't have the same effect nor offer the same advantages as a judicial sale that Justice Rares has already referred to and Stuart Hetherington will deal with shortly. As a consequence, a sale under a writ of execution is unlikely to achieve the same price as a judicial sale, and even may not, and the vessel may not even be sold at all if there are or is a prospect of continuing in rem claims. Fourthly, a ship must be under arrest in the proceeding in which the application for its sale is made. Or to put it another way, an order for the sale of a ship is usually made in the proceeding in which the ship is under arrest. That has procedural consequences where the application for the sale of the ship is made by somebody other than the claimant who arrested it. That leads to the second question, who may apply for an order for the sale of a ship? I've already referred to Rule 69.1, and it says that the sale may be ordered upon an application by a party to a proceeding, and more particularly to the proceeding in which the vessel is under arrest. Clearly that will include the plaintiff or in the proceeding or the party that has arrested the ship. Having regard to the terms of Rule 15 of the Admiralty Rules, it will also include the owner of a ship, at least where the owner is the relevant person in respect of the claim that is the subject of the in rem proceeding and for which the ship is under arrest. One circumstance in which the owner of the ship may wish to have or apply for the sale of the ship is if the proceeds of sale are expected to exceed the in rem claims against the ship, the balance of the proceeds of sale would therefore be remitted to the ship owner. But the ship owner may be concerned that if there is a delay in the sale of the ship, the costs of the arrest will reduce or extinguish that balance of proceeds. For the same reason, a demise charter of a ship, the subject of an action in rem brought under Section 18 of the Act, is also a party to the proceeding and thereby able to seek an order for sale, although one might think that a court would be wary of a demise charterer seeking to have a ship that it does not own sold in order to repay debts owing by it and which are not owed by the owner of the ship. That, especially if there's opposition to the sale from the owner of the ship who would be permitted to intervene for those purposes. However, a party to a proceeding in Rule 69.1 would not include a caveator against release and certainly wouldn't include a person with a potential in rem claim that is not yet the subject of proceedings. If such a caveator or potential claimant wishes to seek the sale of a ship, it would either have to apply to intervene and be joined as a party to the in rem proceeding in which the ship is under arrest in order that it may then apply for the sale of the ship in that proceeding, or commence its own action in rem against the ship and then apply for the ship to be arrested a second time in that proceeding and then seek an order for sale in that proceeding. But whilst the former option is potentially open, and that was also the approach that Justice Shepherd took in the Sculptor Vuketic, Vuchetich and Sculptor Kanenkov proceedings after the vessel had been sold and when in rem claimants were invited to bring claims against the proceeds of sale, in my opinion, for what it's worth, the latter is probably the more appropriate course, and I'm comforted somewhat by that it's consistent with the advice given in paragraph 6.1 of the Admiralty Marshal's Manual. If the ship under arrest is deteriorating in value, the court may order its sale under Rule 69.5 with or without an application. In other words, the court can of its own motion order the sale of the ship if necessary to forestall a deterioration in the value of the security afforded by the ship to the plaintiff or the other in rem claimants. That may have some consequences in relation to who bears the costs of complying with the order for sale in the first instance, for reasons which I'll come to in a moment. In Australia, the position appears to be that the Admiralty Marshal may not apply for an order for the ship. The Admiralty Marshal is not a party to a proceeding, let alone one in which a ship is under arrest. It is perhaps doubtful that whilst the Marshal can seek from the court directions in relation to a ship under Rule 48.1, it's perhaps doubtful that that rule would permit an order for sale to be made, at least in circumstances where it could not be made under Rule 69. Although, at one time, the equivalent rule in England, or rule in equivalent terms, was thought to give the Marshal standing to apply for the sale of a ship there. But if the Marshal is concerned about the ship under arrest deteriorating in value, then the Marshal can draw that to the court's attention and an order for sale made even without any formal application being made by the party. Thirdly, what property is comprised in the sale? Well, it's the sale of a ship. And that traditionally extends to the ship and her appurtenances, and thereby includes all of the ship's tackle, apparel and furniture where carried. Justice Sheen in the Cillia said that when a ship is sold, it includes all property aboard the ship other than that which is owned by someone other than the owner of the ship. It therefore does not include the crew's personal belongings and effects, and Tony will have something to say about that, equipment leased to the ship or to the ship owner, and equipment belonging to a time or demise charterer. It also does not include any property belonging to the ship owner which just happens to be on board the ship at the time of its arrest, but which itself is not part of the ship in the sense described above. And it was in that context that Justice Shepherd in Moore Lyons versus the sculptor Vucetic answered the question, when is a forklift not a forklift? When it's a ship. When His Honour held that forklift trucks and fork hoists on board that vessel at the time of her arrest and used to assist in the loading and unloading of cargo formed part of the ship for the purposes of both her arrest and the order for the sale of the ship. And an application by the ship owner to, in effect, be entitled to remove those forklifts or for their value was dismissed. It's doubtful, I think, for reasons that are set out in the paper which will be made available in due course, that it would include containers on board a ship. This is especially if they're not owned by the ship owner, but leased by the ship owner, but even those containers which are owned by the ship owner are unlikely to sufficiently form part of the ship for the purposes of the judicial sale. More usually, competing claims arise in connection with the bunkers on board the ship at the time it's sold and whether those bunkers or the proceeds of their sale are available to the plaintiff and the other in rem claimants. Whilst the bunkers on board the ship may not amount to an appurtenance of the ship, if they belong to the ship owner at the time of the ship's sale, then the proceeds of their sale form part of the proceeds of the sale of the raise and are available to meet the claims of the in rem claimants. But if the bunkers are owned by a charterer of the ship, such as a time charter or a demise charterer, at the time of its sale, then when the order for sale is made, the bunkers will still be included in the sale and sold along with the ship. This is essentially for pragmatic reasons, but the proceeds of the sale of those bunkers will be accounted for separately from the sale of the ship, and the charterer can then apply for a declaration that the bunkers were its property at the time of the sale and that it's thereby entitled to the proceeds of their sale and an order that the proceeds of sale be paid out to it. This application would be made in the existing in rem proceeding in which the order for sale is made, and it would be made by the charterer applying to intervene in that proceeding. Where that is not in dispute, or if it is dispute that the court determines that the charterer's claim is a valid one, then neither the bunkers nor the proceeds of their sale will be available to satisfy the claims of the plaintiff or any of the other in rem claimants on the ship, and the charterer will be entitled to the balance, to the proceeds of the sale of the bunkers, and will not have to offset it against any claim that the charterer may otherwise have against the ship and which it would seek to pursue against the proceeds of the sale of the ship, because it's not a payment against its claim but simply a payment from a property belonging to it. The relevance of those observations is that if one is acting for a time charterer or possibly demise charter of a ship under arrest, and there is a prospect that an order for the sale of the ship will be made, then whilst there may be an understandable desire on the part of the charterer to bring the charter party to an end, care should nevertheless be taken in how that is done, and in particular so that it's done in such a way that it doesn't result in the charterer losing any possible security that it might otherwise have by a transfer of the ownership of any bunkers on board the vessel which it might own at that time. And that's because typically under both time and demise charter parties, there are provisions that say that when a vessel is redelivered or charter party is terminated, the effect of those provisions is to transfer property of the bunkers back to the owners. And if that happens even after the arrest but before the sale, then the charterer has lost the benefit of those bunkers. Finally, on the question of bunkers, where the bunkers on board the ship at the time of sale are owned by the charterer, issues may arise as to who's liable for the cost of the bunkers consumed during the period in which the vessel is detained and whilst it's being sold. The practice that's been adopted in Australia, both in the Haishi No. 3 and the MSC Sumatra by Justice Lee, has been to treat the cost of the bunkers consumed as a cost of sale and thereby payable to the charterer from the proceeds of sale of the ship with the same priority as the other cost of arrest or cost of sale. Then the fees and expenses of a judicial sale, now that's the touchy point because that's where the practitioner is exposed, or perhaps not. Rule 69.4 of the rules provides that an application under Rule 69.1 for an order for valuation of sale constitutes an undertaking by the party who made it to pay on demand to the marshal an amount equal to the amount of the fees and expenses of the marshal in complying with the order for sale. A number of observations can be made about this. First, the giving of such an undertaking is not inconsistent with the undertaking imposed by both Rule 41 on an applicant for the arrest of a ship and the undertaking imposed by Rule 53 upon an applicant for the release of a ship from arrest. But secondly, the undertaking contemplated by Rule 69.4 appears to be one given by the actual party to the proceeding who seeks the arrest of the ship and not their legal representative. This is in contrast to the current terms of Rules 41, 53, Form 12 and Form 19. Although Form 26, which is the prescribed form for applying for an order for sale, expressly states, I undertake to pay on demand to the marshal an amount equal to the costs and expenses involved and is signed by the legal practitioner, it nevertheless appears from the terms of paragraphs 2 and 3 of that form that the undertaking is still from the party applying for the order rather than its legal representative. That certainly seems to be the position that's adopted by the marshal as reflected in paragraph 6.6 of the marshal's manual, which states that if the party making the application is out of the jurisdiction, there may be difficulties in enforcing any undertaking, and in that case expenditure should not be incurred by the marshal unless funds have already been received from the applicant or some other form of acceptable security has been given. So solicitors sign away. Thirdly, as with the undertaking in support of the arrest of the ship, the marshal can make one or more demands for interim payments on account of the fees and expenses covered by the Rule 69.4 undertaking. This is pursuant to Rule 78b of the rules. Moreover, those demands can also be made in advance of the marshal incurring the expenses. That has some relevance when one comes to identify some of the expenses, which I'll deal with shortly. Fourthly, if an order for sale is made pursuant to Rule 69.5 without any application having been filed, then one consequence of that is that there is no one subject to the undertaking provided for by Rule 69.4. And in that situation, the marshal, which I assume means the court, would have to fund the fees and expenses of complying with the order for sale itself, at least until such time as they could be recovered from the proceeds of sale, assuming that the sale is completed. That is, unless the marshal can make a Rule 78 demand under the Rule 41 undertaking given by the party who arrested the ship in the first place. And depending on the nature of the expenses, that may be possible. For example, birthing hire fees during the period of the sale, which would be also covered by the undertaking as a cost of arrest. But other expenses, such as those directly associated with the sale, would seem unlikely to be fall within that Rule 41 undertaking. Fifthly, as to the types of expenses and associated with the sale of the ship covered by the undertaking, these are listed in paragraph 6.5 of the Marshal's Manual. And the Marshal's practice is to provide the party that's obtained the order for sale with a list of them in advance, so you'll see what they are then. They include costs associated directly with the sale, such as brokerage fees. They include costs incurred by the Marshal in retaining solicitors to act on the sale of the ship, as well as, admittedly, perhaps more unusually, to provide advice on any issues that may arise in the course of the sale, such as insurance, or even to represent the Marshal on contentious applications associated with the sale of the ship, which was the practice during the Turukina. In order to realise the best possible price on the sale of a ship, it may also be necessary for the Marshal to incur certain expenses in connection with the ship, including carrying out necessary or desirable repairs to the ship, paying any outstanding classification fees, society fees, insurance, and paying out any port or other charges outstanding at the time of the ship's arrest, in respect of which the relevant authorities may have a right to detain the ship even after it is sold. These are, of course, all matters that the Marshal would have to fund in the first instance by calling upon the demand given by the party that applied for the order for sale. Where the original arresting party is not the applicant for the sale of the ship, then a question and issues may arise as to whether particular expenses incurred or to be incurred by the Marshal are costs of arrest within Rule 41 or costs of arrest within Rule 69, and who's going to have to pay them first. Some expenses, it may be obvious. Others may fall within both rules, and it may be a matter for the solicitors to deflect the Marshal to the other undertaking giver in order to avoid having to pay those costs. Provided that the ship is sold and the proceeds are sufficient to satisfy all the costs of arrest and sale, then the only practical matter of this is that the party will be out of pocket those amounts for the period in which it takes to sell the ship. But in that regard, that party may be awarded interest on those sums in respect of that period, which interest is recoverable from the proceeds of sale of the ship and enjoys the same high priority as the cost of sale. On that question of priority, as I said, the costs associated with the sale of the ship are afforded a priority in the recovery of the proceeds ahead of all of the substantive claims. That same applies, and this is of some interest to the practitioners, to any legal costs incurred by that party in obtaining the arrest and the sale of the ship, so your client can get your costs on a solicitor-client or indemnity basis. The final three observations I'd make as follows. First, unless the court otherwise orders, the Marshal's costs and expenses are not subject to taxation. That's the terms of Rule 78 capital B, which is an amendment from the original form. And in the Bank of China and the Ship Hire She number 3, Justice Rarey has set out the circumstances in which that prima facie position may be displaced. Secondly, an important cost that may be payable in the event of a sale of a ship is the cost for the repatriation of the crew and any outstanding wages. Where the ship, unless the new purchaser is prepared to take over the crew, which has happened on the last two occasions, as I understand it, normally the sale can't be completed until the crew are repatriated. That means that the party obtaining the order for sale has to pay for their costs of remitting them, sending them home. Those costs are costs of sale. In relation to the crew's wages, the court will usually not insist upon the crew leaving the ship without first being paid off. And where the payment of the wages is not made by the owner, then it will usually fall upon the arresting party or the party seeking the sale to pay their wages. Where that is done pursuant to the leave of the court or by order of the court, then the party paying those wages will have the same priority that the crew would have otherwise had in relation to their wages claim, which is, in effect, the next priority under the cost of arrest and sale. But there is no such right of subrogation where the payment is made voluntarily. So beware if you pay out the crew without seeking an order first. The final point is dealing with cargo on board the ship, and Sarah's, Professor Derrington has already touched on this slightly. Where cargo is on board a ship at the time of the arrest, the cargo is not itself under arrest and the cargo owner can usually apply for the cargo to be discharged, but that is at its expense and it would usually have to indemnify the marshal in respect of the cost of the discharge. If the cargo owner makes no such application, then before the ship sale can be completed, the cargo has to be removed. The marshal will normally advise the cargo owners to do this, but if it's not done, then the marshal has power to remove the cargo. But where the cargo is removed in preparation for the sale of the vessel, the costs of doing so do not form part of the costs of arrest or sale, and the marshal, therefore, does not or is not entitled to look to the arresting party or the party seeking the sale to cover those costs. Rather, the marshal has, in effect, a lien over those costs, and in the event that the party who owns the cargo doesn't pay them, then the marshal can sell the cargo and recover its expenses from the proceeds of sale. That is perhaps one slight glimmer on the question of costs. The final point that I'd make in this regard is really to hark back to what happened in Patrick's and the Turrican. Patrick's arrested the ship and it remained under arrest for a period of time and incurred significant expenses in that regard. But a mortgagee came along with a much higher priority, which was likely to exhaust the proceeds of the sale of the ship, so Patrick's didn't really want to incur any further expenses in arranging for its sale. The mortgagee did apply, and the mortgagee ended up bearing those costs. At the end of the day, after expending several hundreds of thousands of dollars, most of which admittedly were recovered from the proceeds of sale, the exercise meant that Patrick's didn't recover a cent against their substantive claim. So whilst the judicial sale of a ship may be seen as the means of enforcing one's claim, it's not always as successful as one would hope. Thank you.
I now want to introduce Registrar Cesarero, who I think is known to almost everyone. He's an institution in the court. He's been a registrar for 26 years. Those of us who've practiced in the field and also who now sit judicially know that he's a person who knows anything and everything about the practical aspects of arresting a ship and keeping her under arrest and selling her. He's been doing this for almost all of the time. He's been with the court and he's almost one of our treasures, like our Royal Maces. Can I introduce Tony?
Thank you, Judge. The process of a judicial sale in the Federal Court is quite settled. General information about judicial sales in the court is to be found in the Marshal's Manual on the court's website. At the time when an order for the arrest of a ship is issued, an Admiralty Marshal is assigned to the ship under the guidance of a registrar, who will in turn report to the Admiralty Registry Coordinating Judge in the registry where the ship is located. That team will usually continue throughout the sale process. At the time when an arrest warrant is executed, while still on the ship, the Marshal speaks to the master of the vessel and explains the consequences of the arrest of his ship. The Marshal will also seek an inventory from the master of the quantity of water, provisions, medical supplies and fuel aboard the ship, and inquiries are made as to the condition of the crew and if they're being paid. The Marshal thus understands the status and condition of the ship and the crew that he has custody of. This information will become important if the arrest is a long one and if the Marshal is required to sell the vessel. Recognising that every sale throws up different problems, what follows is the usual process by way of a timeline of a judicial sale in the court. Generally following the execution of the arrest warrant, a week or so is allowed for the settlement of the dispute to occur. By the second week, if the ship is still under arrest, the matter is listed for a case management conference before the Admiralty Registry Coordinating Judge. If there's no appearance filed on behalf of the ship, unless there's good reason not to do so, the court would expect an application for summary judgment and for sale to be filed and be heard in the week or two after that first case management conference. In the meantime, the court would usually order the marshal to have the defendant ship valued in writing, and to seek advice from a shipbroker generally as to the appropriate method of sale. Week 4 from arrest, after the hearing of the interlocutory application, obviously if the court accepts the evidence of the plaintiff, the court orders that a judgment be entered for the plaintiff, and the following orders would usually be made, and see Form 27 of the Admiralty Rules for this. The marshal to sell the ship, the marshal to retain a named broker to act as broker and assist in the marshal for the sale, the method of sale be determined by the court, the marshal retain a solicitor experience in the sale of commercial ships to act for the marshal in the sale of the ship, the marshal to move the ship to a commercial port, and we'll talk about that later, for provisioning the ship, supplying diesel and so forth, and for crew amenities and for easy access for purchaser inspections. The marshal or the plaintiff would be at liberty to repatriate the crew to a level not lower than the ship's minimum manning requirements. The marshal would be at liberty to pay crew wages and any repatriation costs as and when they fall due, and the marshal to open a US currency account. Week 5 from arrest. In the meantime, the marshal has sought advice from a broker as to the method of sale and has engaged a solicitor. The marshal returns to court for the following orders. The sale of the ship X be affected by, and usually, and this is the method we've used generally, by a closed bid tender in accordance with attached terms and conditions. The bids to close at noon on a date in 4 weeks' time, and the marshal to cause advertisements to be published in a form that the marshal considers appropriate. Now, what we generally do for a large commercial vessel is, on the advice of the broker, is usually advertising for over a 3 week period in the Lloyd's listed in Tradewinds. Obviously, if it's a fishing vessel in Australian waters or a yacht or something, then would it be advertised in a local paper on the Australian? Week 9 from arrest, after the time allocated for bids to close, they're open, and the court would order that the marshal accept the tender of the highest bid. If the highest bid is not over the valuation, the marshal would approach the court to either sell at the highest bidder or to re-advertise. There has been, in recent times, a sale that was just under the valuation, but the court, being a commercial court and being pragmatic, ordered the sale of the vessel to proceed. The highest bidder immediately execute the marshal's conditions of sale, and the highest bidder pay the purchase price plus an adjustment for bunker fuel, lubricants and any other consumables. The date is set for the court to hear priority claims, usually in about 3 weeks' time, and on payment of the purchase price, the ship is released from arrest. At this point, the marshal would normally seek an order to repatriate the crew and would be working with the shipping agent for a smooth transition. Week 10 from arrest, the court orders that the marshal pay the final wages to crew, solicitor's fees for acting for the marshal, and broker fees. Week 12 from arrest, the court would hear priority claims and make orders as to payment out to creditors and the plaintiff to be paid the balance of the purchase price. Now, I'm just going to go through some issues that have come, that have arisen over the years in relation to judicial sales. In relation to Rule 47 of the Admiralty Rules, providing that the marshal who arrests the ship has custody of the ship, and also giving the marshal authority to retain safe custody and preserve the ship or property, allowing the marshal to remove cargo that's under arrest or to remove cargo from a ship that's under arrest, and also to move a ship. A marshal would normally, unless it was an emergency, seek an order from the court, and I'll talk about that later, rather than take that responsibility themselves. Subrule 2A of Rule 47, the marshal may, when considering moving a ship under arrest, take into consideration the operational requirements of the port authority where the ship is to be held in custody. Rule 2B talks about the marshal may, at any time after the ship has been arrested, demand and take possession of the original certification documents of the ship. Now, Rule 48 of the Admiralty Rules provides that if a marshal has custody of a ship or other property, the marshal or party may at any time apply to the court for directions with respect to the ship or property. That's the rule the marshal would tend to use to approach a judge and seek an order to discharge cargo or move the vessel, rather than take that responsibility themselves. But they can do it, and sometimes do. As I say, Rule 47 gives those extensive powers to the marshal. In relation to the power under subrule 2A, allowing the marshal to take into account the operational requirements with the port where the ship is to be held in custody, almost from the time of the arrest, the marshal's under pressure as to where to hold the ship. There's virtually no laybers to be found in any commercial port in Australia. Marshals are required to work with harbour masters and port authorities with every arrest and cannot tie up a loading berth and will try to arrest at anchor prior to the ship coming to berth. As the arrest progresses, the problem is to where to keep the ship for a number of weeks pending the sale. Leaving it at anchor offshore creates risk that the ship may flee the jurisdiction, and keeping it inside the harbour has its own problems, such as the cost of having a ship to lie alongside a berth and sometimes requires moves from berth to berth. If the marshal is lucky, it should be allowed to anchor inside the harbour. Talking about Rule 47, Subrule 2B, giving the power to the marshal to remove the ship's certificates, that gives the marshal some comfort that the ship will not flee the jurisdiction, but it's sometimes very hard to pry those documents away from the master of a vessel. In relation to the condition of the sale, is very relevant to today's discussions that Clause 5 of the standard Admiralty Marshal condition of sale provides that, although the effect under the Admiralty law of this judicial sale is to free the vessel from all liens, encumbrances and debts up to the date of sale, no warranties are made by the Admiralty Marshal as to the effect of this sale under any foreign laws and or foreign jurisdictions. The buyer shall not be entitled to reject the vessel nor any damages or diminution of price by reason of any refusal by the courts or registry of a foreign country to recognise this sale and or recognise its effect under Australian law. In relation to repatriation of crew, we've been very lucky. The last commercial ships, purchaser has kept the crew kept the crew and continued the original voyage planned by the original owners of the ship. So we've been very lucky not to have to repatriate the crew. In relation to personal effects, in the collapse of the Baltic Shipping Company in the mid-1990s and the sale of the ships Sculptor Vedicic and Sculptor Konakov, issues arose as to what were personal effects of the crew. Some crew members in what was a very early form of eBay were taking orders and acquiring goods from overseas ports for customers back home in Russia. When the marshal commenced work to repatriate the crew, some crew had large consumer items, including car tyres and other vehicle spare parts in their cabins, and were seeking that the marshal repatriate the goods with them. Didn't happen. In relation to cargo, Greg's already touched on this. The owner of a cargo is not itself under arrest, can apply to the marshal under Rule 49.1 and 2 or the court under 49.3 to have the cargo discharged. The cost of discharging the cargo is not a cost of the arrest of the sale, however, the cost of to the cargo owners. Marshals go out of their way when they arrest a ship to make sure that it's not loaded. It must be assumed that every arrest will lead to an order for the sale of the vessel. Having said that, if ship is actually loading or unloading at the time the marshal intends to arrest it, that process is nearly completed, the marshal will wait to arrest the ship. Once the marshal arrests the ship, all loading or unloading would be stopped. If the ship is loaded when arrested, the discharge of cargo would be another step in the process to be managed by the marshal for the judicial sale. Repairs. The marshal will only undertake those repairs that are necessary to make the ship seaworthy. The ship is sold as is, where is. Having said that, recently the sale of a luxury yacht, the marshal spent $100 or a couple hundred dollars getting the yacht cleaned by water pressure to make it more marketable on the advice of the broker. The crew. Morale is very important during a long arrest. Some say sailors are used to being confined on ships for long extended periods, so there shouldn't be a problem. However, with extended arrests pending judicial sales, they are stuck in one place with a lot of spare time with the uncertainty about their future employment. We've had a stabbing of a crew member during an arrest, so the potential for conflict is why the court presses ahead to make an order to sell the ship rather than let it languish for weeks. Marshals will always consider the welfare of the crew, and if an order for sale is made, the ship is at a remote port, like for example Abbott Point in Queensland, which has no crew or recreational facilities, the marshal will seek approval from the court to move the ship to a port that has them. And this will have the added advantage of making it more easily accessible for potential purchasers. Sometimes it does not take much to keep a crew happy. In one arrest of a ship which had been lying offshore for some time, Justice Rarey's, after being alerted to by the marshal that the crew was getting a bit fidgety, spoke to the master by phone during a hearing, and the master of the vessel was on loudspeaker in open court. So upon questioning by the judges to the morale of the crew, the master, in a very heavy Eastern European accent, bellowing through the courtroom, said, "The crew want cigarettes. Give them cigarettes. The crew make no trouble." With that, I finish. Thank you.
Our final speaker is Stuart Hetherington. He is a leading and eminent practitioner in this field and has been since before I began practice. His status now is recognised both in this country and internationally because he's been, as I mentioned earlier, the president of the Committee Maritime Internationale since 2014 and has led that body with distinction. He's a partner of Colin Biggers and Paisley and a member of its transport and logistics team in the firm's offices in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. Stuart.
Thank you very much, Judge, Your Honours, ladies and gentlemen. It's a bit embarrassing being the last speaker and keeping you from a drink, but I'll move as quickly as I can. CMI has been mentioned, obviously. Let me just say a few things about CMI to put this all into context, especially for those who don't know quite who CMI is. It was formed in 1897 in Antwerp. It's responsible for the drafting of most of the international maritime conventions that we deal with on a day-to-day basis in the maritime area. And in fact, I was told the story for the first time the other day. One of the great personalities of the CMI in the post-war years was a guy called Bill Birch Renison, who was the senior partner of Thomas L. Miller for many years, was a vice president of the CMI, and I learned that he and Lord Devlin drafted the first draft of the Civil Liability Convention 1969 on the Noble Lord's kitchen table before CMI then took it on from them and presented it to the IMO, and the rest, as they say, is history. While we're reminiscing, of course, this year also marks, as well as being the 120th year of CMI, it marks 50 years since the Torrey Canyon went down, and we should all be grateful for that, for the work that's come our way since then. Sarah used the word convention in talking about the draft instrument, which I'll continue to describe it as, in talking about it on judicial sales in this presentation. It isn't a convention yet, it's very much a draft, and that's what I'm going to be talking about. The CMI, as I've said, might seem a bit presumptuous in this day and age when it doesn't have the same relationship with Belgium as it did. Of course, it was formed in Antwerp, and what happened to all the early conventions that CMI drafted was the Belgian government called diplomatic conference. So all those early conventions, the Hague rules, whatever, were all done at Brussels. And that's the reason why the CMI grew to prominence, that it had that ability to get international conventions through. Sadly, since the United Nations came into being and all those other organs of the UN came into being, they're really the only route to get an international convention through, and I'll come to that in a moment. So the history of the judicial sales draft starts in 2007. Henry Lee, who is on the Executive Council of the CMI, is a professor of maritime law in China and a practitioner, said there's a problem. In Asia, they have a huge number of sales, judicial sales of ships, and they're not being recognised throughout the region. And I suppose if there's one takeaway from what I want to say this evening, is that the utility of a judicial sale is dependent on international comity. If there's no international comity, and if other countries don't recognise the judicial sale in a particular country, then people are going to stop buying them. So what we're about and what we've tried to do with this instrument is create this instrument, which will become an international convention, and which will restore that comity which seems to be missing. And I'll come to give you some examples of that in a moment. So the Executive Council decided CMI would look into the problem. As ever, we started off with a questionnaire which goes out to the 50 or so maritime law associations. And then we hold meetings, not necessarily annually, but we held one in Buenos Aires in 2010, Beijing 2012, Dublin 2013, Hamburg in 2014. At each of those meetings, drafting work, as in an international conference, was done on this topic. And in 2014 in Hamburg, the Assembly meeting approved the wording of the draft instrument. And let me just tell you briefly what's in it. You can see it on the CMI website, comitemaritime.org, as indeed you can see the questionnaire that was originally sent out, the responses from all the MLAs, the papers that were given at conferences, a wealth of material there, including some of the more recent material which we've presented to the UN bodies that I'll refer to. But in terms of what the convention does, it's largely a procedural document. It's setting out what you need to do in order to reach a point at which hopefully the judicial sales will get recognised. Under Article 3, the parties need, or the registrar of the place where the ship's under arrest and the judicial sale is taking place, need to send a notice to the ship where the place where the ship's registered, to the owners, just make sure the owners know about it, the bareboat charterer, if there's a registered bareboat charterer around, and generally just sets out in that first Article 3, after a definitions article, sorry, in Article 1, what needs to happen in order to constitute a proper judicial sale. But basically it's following the rules of the state concerned, and it's the sort of things you've heard about this evening that has to happen. Article 4 is the crux of it. It's confirming what you've heard from various speakers tonight. What is the effect of a judicial sale? The title to and the rights of and interests in the ship are extinguished, and the new owner takes a clean hull, as Justice Rear has started the evening saying. And then Article 5, there's an annexure to the draft instrument, which is a certificate which the court will then issue. And I can just read you the first paragraph. The rest of the document is a page and a couple of lines, is just filling in blanks, information about the ship and the owner and the purchaser. But the opening paragraph says, this is to certify that the ship described below has been sold by way of judicial sale and all conditions required by the law of the state of the judicial sale and by the international convention, we call it in this an international convention, although it isn't yet, on foreign judicial sales of ships and their recognition have been met. And the clean title, as defined by the convention, that's Article 4, has been transferred to the named purchaser, and any title to and all rights and interests in the ship existing prior to the judicial sale are extinguished, and any mortgage or charge, except as assumed by the purchaser, shall cease to attach the ship. So it's a very practical document. So there's the certificate. Article 6 then says that on presentation of that certificate to the register where the ship had been registered, it will be deregistered. So the very presentation of that certificate should cause the deregistration of the certificate. So Jesper Martin's client, who's got the problem in the federal court at the moment, wouldn't have to be suing in Taiwan. The registry in Taiwan would have received a certificate from the Singaporeans, assuming they were both parties to this convention, and it would have been deregistered. So that's one practical impact of what we've drafted. Article 7 goes on to talk about the recognition of the judicial sale by state parties. So going now beyond the change of register, what happens if that ship is then rearrested in relation to a claim that someone had prior to the sale? Well, Article 7 tells them what they've got to do, and that is dismiss the arrest. That claim cannot be made against that ship. So that's essentially the mischief that the draft conventions has sought to repair. So what does CMI do now? We finished it a couple of years ago, 2014. Well, we've been touting it around different international bodies, trying to get someone to pick it up. We first went to the IMO Legal Committee, with whom we do a huge amount of work, a lot of current projects with them, especially the unmanned ships project. Sadly, the IMO Legal Committee seems to be in a state at which it doesn't want to take on any legal work, although the Canadian who's on the CMI Executive Council tells me there's a new vice president there who's a Canadian, and she thinks that mood is changing and they might be keener to have us. But we made two presentations to them in 2015 and 2016 and tried to persuade them to put it on their work agenda. And they've got nothing else on it, I should say, but they declined to take it on. So the next port of call we went to was the Hague Conference on Private International Law. The reason for that was we discovered that they've got some work currently, that they're quite a long way down the track on recognition of judgments. And we felt it could slot into that project quite well, even as a separate part at the end of the work they've already done. And so earlier this year, we made a pitch to the group who's actually working on that judgment. So they had a meeting in The Hague. And Jonathan Lux, some of you may know, ex-InstantCo partner, is retired, went, and he and Henry Lee ran with this project. They chaired and were the reporter, respectively, on the CMI International Working Group. And so they went and made the same pitch they'd made to the IMO Legal Committee to this meeting at The Hague. Sadly, again, The Hague conference people decided they had too much on their work agenda and it wasn't appropriate to add it to the judgments project because it was too far advanced for the sort of various reasons given. So we were then invited, they had a council meeting of The Hague a couple of weeks later, and I was due to be in Antwerp for a CMI meeting the week before, so arranged to go over to speak to the council at The Hague conference in the building alongside, I don't know if anyone knows The Hague, and the Peace Palace. It is the most unbelievable building that one of those rich American industrialists financed many years ago, Carnegie. Unbelievable place. Anyway, I was invited to go to their council meeting and make a pitch to do the work, and did so, not with a view to them making a decision on it, because it was really their first knowledge of the project, apart from what the other group had heard a couple of weeks before, but to inform them and see whether they'd be interested. There was a pretty lukewarm response. Again, they've got too much work on, they don't want to necessarily take it on, but we're invited to go back next year and make another pitch. So then we got word from the Canadian delegate who'd been at the Hague meeting. He'd heard what we had to say, and she said, you'd be better off going to UNCITRAL. They haven't got as much work on at the moment, and they might be prepared to take it on. UNCITRAL, bear in mind, was the UN body that the Rotterdam Rules went to from CMI after we finished and drafted that document. UNCITRAL took it on. And so we worked very closely with Kate Lannan, who's on the secretariat there, and Renaud Solier, who's the soon-to-be-retired Secretary-General. So I spoke to them, and they said, yes, we'd be interested in it. We've got our council meeting on the 14th of July this year, if you'd like to come across and make the pitch there. So Jonathan and Henry went to do their act again and made their pitch on the 14th of July, and this is the result. There was support for the view that UNCITRAL was well placed to resolve the private international law issues raised by the proposal in a technical and non-politicised environment. And it was observed that in discussions at the Hague Conference, a number of delegations had expressed the view that the proposal would be best taken up in UNCITRAL. It was also considered doubtful that the proposal fell within the IMO's mandate, given its focus on public international law and on more technical issues relating to safety and the protection of the environment. A number of delegations supported the proposal and expressed their interest in taking it up, subject to the availability of working group resources and any necessary consultation with other organisations. While swift resolution of the questions raised by the proposal was encouraged, the Commission agreed that additional information in respect of the breadth of the problem would be useful, that the proposal could be reconsidered by the Commission at a future session. It was therefore suggested the CMI might seek to develop and advance the proposal by holding a colloquium so as to provide additional information to the Commission and allow it to take an informed decision in due course. The Commission thanked CMI for its proposal and noted the importance of the issues raised. It decided not to refer the proposal to a working group at this time, but agreed that UNCITRAL, through its secretariat and states, would support and participate in a colloquium to be initiated by CMI to discuss and advance the proposal. The Commission agreed to revisit the matter at a future session. So we're not there yet. There's a long way to go, and there's a huge amount of time being taken in making all these presentations to them. So what is the prevalence of the problem? We've heard about one case in Sydney currently. Prior to that, subject to anyone else in the audience or in any other state who recalls a judicial sale which resulted in a problem, either the new ship owner not being able to register it, or a subsequent arrest that it had to defend and say, you know, go away. Is there a problem? Well, Henry Lee told us there was in 2007. A figure that has been mentioned in the countries of Korea, China, Singapore and Japan, between 2010 and 2014, there were 480 ship sales. Of those, I don't know how many generated problems. But that gives you an inkling as to quite how different the world is up there compared with here, and what a problem it will be if industry loses confidence in the whole judicial sale process. Just think a minute as to who are the beneficiaries of judicial sales. Firstly, I suppose secured creditors come first. They're the ones who benefit most. Then general creditors. Those general creditors could be anyone who's dealt with the ship, ranging from government instrumentalities right through to providors, stevedores, anyone who's owed money by a ship. So if potential buyers fear that subsequent owners, that as the new owner, they're going to have problems down the track, they're either not going to bid or they're going to put very low bids in, which means all those potential beneficiaries are going to lose out. It's a question of confidence, as I think I said earlier, and there have been too many examples of things going wrong. The numerous judicial statements which are in the materials, if anyone wants to see the materials, we put a huge submission through to each of these organisations we've been to. We've set out there's about 10 cases from about 1960 to date in which the judges have in effect been tearing their hair out saying, why is this coming before me? Why do I have to deal with this? Why wasn't it accepted at the port where the registration was that they wouldn't change? Or why someone re-suing about an older debt? So all I can say is please lobby your local MP, try and get Australia on side. Despite all my best endeavours, after coming back from The Hague and deciding that UNCITRAL was probably the place to try next, I tried to find out who from Australia would be attending the UNCITRAL meeting. Despite numerous emails, telephone calls, forwarding lots of material to various people, no one was able to tell me who would be there. The last couple of UNCITRAL meetings, partners of law firms in the Paris office in one case, and I think the Vienna office in the other case, international law firms that Australian law firms have connections with, just get sent along to this UNCITRAL meeting. So I wanted to speak to that person so that they knew what this topic was all about, and in the hope that Australia would support it. I wasn't given that opportunity. Australia, I don't think, had a word to say about it. At least I haven't heard what they said. They certainly didn't support it. There's a head-in-the-sand approach, and we need to get them doing something. Thanks very much.
I should have mentioned at the beginning that the seminar is being recorded and the audio will be available on the court's website shortly for people who you know who are unable to attend, or if you want to listen to anything from tonight's presentations. And hopefully the speakers will make some of their papers available, which we would ordinarily put up on the website. What I now wanted to do was to ask if there are any questions from our audience. I'll ask in Sydney first and then move clockwise around Australia, going south, west, north, and then closing. So is there anyone in Sydney who would like to ask a question? And if there is, we've got a microphone here. We'll make a point. You're all very tame and waiting for the drinks that we're going to have in Sydney and in Brisbane. Is there any... Oh, sorry, there is a question, yes.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, they're all too shy, Your Honour. I'm Dave Bide. I'm a ship surveyor and a consultant. And the one thing that concerns me more than anything about ship arrests and all this sort of thing is not the money or who's going to lose something like that. It's the welfare of the crew, because they're involuntary involved in it. They're stuck on these ships now for longer and longer and longer time. When I first went to sea, I did 2 years on the one ship, but I used to get ashore and it was not a particular problem. These days, people have a contract. The Far Eastern gentleman with no cigarettes, for example, he was probably on board for, say, a six-month contract. So if he gets arrested at the end of his 6 months, he could be another 6 months. Remember the sculptor ships in Sydney? Those guys were on board for over a year before they were sent home. So... Stuart, I don't know whether we could include in the new document some sort of method by which that a ship's crew could be repatriated immediately the ship is arrested, and then I know the ship has to be maintained, so the marshal could then look to some sort of method by which the ship is looked after by an incoming crew. So that's my concern, is for the human rights of the people on board the ships these days. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I can say from the court's point of view, we are, as Tony Tesoro said, very concerned with the welfare of the crew, and we do inquire about that. And one of the issues is how many you need to keep on board to keep the safe manning levels. But you need, if you've got a working ship, you've got to have a crew on board. Another matter is to make sure they've got phone cards to see if they can get paid, to take them to shore, whatever, and usually you can get the master, the marshal will get the master involved, and that works out. But that is certainly a concern that the judges and the marshals have to make sure that crime is looked after. Are there any other comments or questions in Sydney? Can I move to Melbourne? Is there anyone in Melbourne who would like to ask a question or say something?
Yes, there is, Your Honour.
Yes.
I want to, it's Paul Willie. I wanted to thank the panel for the presentations that have come before us tonight and raise what may be covered by Stewart's convention. My concern is with a situation, for example, in relation to China and Taiwan, both having significant shipping interests. Is there any provision in the convention to deal with a situation which might arise and has arisen in the past, for example, in relation to piracy, where the Chinese government refuses to contemplate any recognition of anything done in China, in Taiwan, and vice versa, on the basis that they are one and the same nation, not two separate nations?
I think the simple answer is no, Paul. Taiwan's not recognised internationally. In fact, you might be able to help me out at the next Executive Council meeting and Assembly meeting of the CMI. We have an application before us for Taiwan, who wants to join the CMI. It's formed a maritime law association, and I'm having great difficulty working out quite what we're going to do about that. The answer is international law and the UN sidesteps the issue. And I don't think there's anything that we could put in our convention that would overcome it.
Are there any other questions or comments from Melbourne?
No, there's not. No, you're wrong.
Well, I managed to forget our national capital. My sense of geography is obviously terrible. Is there anyone in Canberra who has a comment or a question?
Nothing in the ACT, Your Honour.
That's a relief. Hobart?
No questions from Hobart.
Thank you.
No, Your Honour.
And Adelaide?
We've got one question here.
Yes.
Just
a quick question, Ian Maitland, to Greg Nell. If the arresting party has supplied the bunkers, do they get any priority?
You mean in relation to the sale of those bunkers?
Yes.
Well, if they've supplied the bunkers, they will have paid for them, so presumably they will not be bunkers owned by the owner, they won't be bunkers owned by the charterer, and therefore they presumably will be entitled to be either given those bunkers back if they want them, or to take the proceeds of sale of the bunkers. But if the marshal has supplied the bunkers, it will have done so funded by them. Now, the only difficulty might be with that is if those bunkers have been supplied, then intermingled with bunkers that belong to the owner or belong to the time charterer, then there may be a problem about who gets the bunkers or whether you get some proportion of them. But any more detailed answer to that would require a cost disclosure.
Any other attempts to get some free legal advice? Or are there any other questions from Adelaide?
No, I don't think so.
What about Perth?
I don't think there's any questions here. Thank you.
And Brisbane?
Definitely not.
No questions for Brisbane, Your Honour.
Well, can I ask you all please to thank our presenters. We have a small token of gratitude, but they've all put in a tremendous effort and given us, I think you'll agree, a very informative and entertaining evening, and I'd like you all to thank them in the usual way.